You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Check out our website at thetakeaway.org. You'll find other interesting stories, quizzes, and behind-the-scenes photos and videos.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening on this last day of 2013. And it's the day when we're collecting your most memorable moments of the year.
This is Mike Walton from Salt Lake City. My moment of 2013 was when gay marriage was legalized here in Utah. It shocked us all, and many, many of my friends were married when they didn't think they would have that chance for many, many years.
Travis from Denton, Texas, and my favorite moment in 2013 was when I graduated from college with my degree.
You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with the moment, personal or newsworthy, of 2013 that stands out most for you. Maybe you're like this listener from North Haven, Connecticut, who writes to us, "The most memorable moment of 2013 for me was the selection of the new pope and the choosing of Francis as his name. It gave me hope that my church may get back to its original mission of helping the poor and the discriminated against." That idea of the church returning to its original mission, ushering in a new era of spiritual awakening and bringing lapsed Catholics back to the fold, maybe, is one that we wanted to explore at the beginning of this hour. The arrival of Pope Francis was an emotional moment that a lot of you experienced live on this program earlier this year. Listen.
He's a Jesuit priest. I am a Jesuit priest. The first Jesuit in history to be a priest. He's from Argentina.
That was the moment that our guest, Father Matthew Gamber, realized who the Pope was back in March. Of course, it was Pope Benedict's resignation that led to that change in leadership. Soon afterward, Francis became the first Latin American, the first Jesuit, and the first to take the name Francis to head the Vatican. And in the short 10 months since, he's made a lot of news, seeming to reorient the church, at least rhetorically, on issues like poverty and gay marriage. And certainly gotten a big response from the world's 1.2 billion Catholics. Francis has an 88% approval rating among American Catholics and a remarkable 75% approval rating amongst Americans in general, Catholics and non-Catholics together. Sister Simone Campbell counts herself among those fans. She's the executive director of NETWRC, that's a national Catholic social justice lobby, and she says that to her, the Pope has already brought about some significant changes.
One of the big changes is that many of us within the church have always worked with the poor and have kept that at the heart of our mission. But the difference is that our leadership, the Pope, hasn't been aware of it. And in fact, in 2012, the Leadership Conference of Women Religious got censured for spending too much time. I mean, the document actually says they spend too much time working with the poor and not enough of addressing abortion and gay marriage. I mean, so the Vatican certainly has changed with the Pope's leadership, has changed at least its approach, its words, its acknowledgement of the important work with the poor, that Jesus was about working with the poor.
It's probably too soon for me to ask you what major changes have happened on the ground because the Pope has now changed the message from Rome on these important issues. But what do you expect over the next decade? Do you expect a transformation in the church's approach to how it deals with poor people?
Well, I think that the change will be in how our leadership speaks about it and in how priests in the parish, bishops around the world will speak about the integration of the good news of the gospel and the focus on the poor. I mean, the fact is that Jesus calls us to be with those who suffer all the time. And that message has not been communicated by bishops of late. And so I think eventually this will result in changes in orientation. The other thing that we miss often is that the reason all of us are called to respond to the needs of the least is so that our hearts are broken open to everyone. When you're sensitive to everyone, then the world of solidarity changes. I care about you as much as I care about myself. That's what Jesus calls us to.
One of the most sort of unblinkered, maybe, views of the new message of Pope Francis and of the church, Sister Simone, is maybe a political one, maybe a cynical one. Look, the world is having a different conversation about Rome and the Vatican and the Catholic Church than it was this time last year. The world is no longer talking about scandal and about abuse and about some horrific things that were either condoned or had Rome looking the other way. Without suggesting that there's too much cynical coming out of Rome in terms of political messaging. Is that a fair criticism, do you think?
No, actually, I don't, because Pope Francis has made it abundantly clear that the sin of the church has been in abuse. He's appointed people who, a whole commission that's working hard to address the issues of abuse and to root it out and to atone for the sin of the past. He's not hiding it, but the fact is that it is part of the whole church's call to conversion. I mean, he himself speaks of his own need for conversion and for change. I mean, that's pretty historic from the Pope. So I think that the engagement and prevention of further abuse in the future is certainly at the center of his concern.
One of the remarkable things that Pope Francis has said this year is that people spend too much time worrying about gay marriage. He has said that gay people should be approached with the same love and compassion, and that they can be good people. They are good people. And at the same time, no doctrinal changes or any suggestion of a change in Catholic doctrine. Should people be waiting for a change in doctrine and not just message, or is a change in message enough on that issue?
Well, I'm not sure that a change in message is enough, but certainly I don't expect big doctrinal shifts. The church moves very slowly. I mean, it's a 2,000-year-old organization. It took 350 years to figure out Galileo might be right. So it's not noted for rapid change at all. But the fact is of embracing this whole idea of mercy and care is a huge step forward. And I think we'll have to wait and see how the more specific doctrinal issues play out. But having a heart for everyone who struggles is a huge change in the right direction.
He is still the Pope and he is still the guardian of Catholic doctrine, of course, Sister Simone. And one of the things that's in the news just these last couple of days is the excommunication of a priest, I believe in Australia, Friar Greg Reynolds, for teaching that women could be ordained. Did that disappoint you?
Yes, it does. I mean, the fact is, I mean, there's several disappointments, things that I would just want, you know, a miracle to change immediately, but it hasn't happened. So we're still in the human condition of struggling forward. I mean, one of the examples for me is the appointment of Bishop Blair from Toledo. He was the Bishop of Toledo. He got promoted to the Hartford, Connecticut diocese. And for me, that was pretty distressing and shocking in the American church, because he is one of the most vigilant and eager censures of persons who is censuring the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. And he doesn't know much about us, and yet he is leading this crusade. So I was really concerned that he got promoted. But then after that, Pope Francis redoes the group that decides who bishops will be. So he appoints some more moderate men to that position, and hopefully we will have better choices in the future. It's a slow process.
A slow process, and a time of some concern for Sister Simone Campbell, but also a time of great, great hope as we look toward Rome and the reorientation of the church under Pope Francis. Sister Simone Campbell of the National Catholic Social Justice Lobby Network. Thank you, Sister.
Thank you.
Well, we just heard Sister Simone say that Pope Francis has so far responded strongly to sexual abuse within the Catholic Church. She mentioned the commission that Pope Francis has said he will set up in the Vatican. It's a commission to protect children from sexual abuse. The panel is expected to re-examine how the church handles victims and allegations, from screening and training priests to the pastoral response to abuse. The commission has the potential to fundamentally change the way the church deals with abuse, but for many, potential in this situation just isn't enough. David Clossy is one person who wants to see much more from Pope Francis and from the church. He's executive director of Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP. David, welcome.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Well, David, we'll get to the church's response, Pope Francis's response to sexual abuse in a minute. But more broadly, I just wanted to ask you, as someone with this history, do you see the church under Pope Francis as fundamentally changing or just changing the conversation?
Well, certainly it's early in his papacy, and we try our best in SNAP to be hopeful. But at this point, it's a lot of words, it's a lot of gestures, nothing really concrete. Words and gestures are important, to be sure, but we think that he's got a long way to go.
And do you, as the victim of abuse yourself and somebody who leads an organization like this, share at least part of the view that some have expressed that while the Pope's new focus on the poor and on not marginalizing gay people or abortion necessarily means that people aren't discussing scandal anymore and it's sort of been pushed to another part of the public consciousness?
Oh, I think certainly the abuse crisis is beginning to recede thanks in large part to this Pope. I don't think that's a good thing. You know, for all of his warmth and humility and likability, he really has not taken a single tangible step to protect a single child or expose a single predator or discipline a single enabler or a supervisor who has ignored or is ignoring child sex crimes. So, you know, it's decisive action is what protects kids, not warm, fuzzy feelings, not compassionate public comments, not sweet, sympathetic gestures. And that's what has been lacking in this Pope and his predecessors.
And the commission that Sister Simone mentioned that the Pope is setting up is empty to you or just a start?
Well, at this point, he hasn't even appointed the members of it, so it's way too early to make a judgment. I will say, however, that there have been, over the past 25 years across the globe, there have been hundreds, literally hundreds and hundreds of internal church panels appointed by bishops and other high-ranking church officials to look at abuse. And the church as an institution has been dealing with clergy sex crimes and cover-ups for centuries. So it's really important for us to recall, you know, to keep in mind that even though there's a change of leadership at the top, there's tremendous experience within the church hierarchy on this issue. So they don't need a study commission. They don't need a panel of experts to tell them what to do. In many ways, it's crystal clear the steps that must be taken to safeguard kids. But it's equally clear that church officials just do not have the courage to take those steps.
Despite a commission that Pope Francis has announced to address sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, screening and training of priests and pastoral care for victims, David Clossy says it's not enough and that action has not yet been taken under this new papacy. David Clossy is executive director of the Survivors Network for those abused by priests, otherwise known as SNAP. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, all this hour, we're asking you about the New Year's resolutions you made 1 year ago. What were they, and did you keep them?
This is Daniel from Dallas, Texas. My resolution that I set last year was to raise my college GPA to a 3.5. I unfortunately did not meet that goal.
Leah in New York writes to us, my resolution was to try not to gossip. I also ask others to tell me not to gossip. Tell me when I gossip. I have been successful to a great extent. That's not what I heard. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to share your resolutions for 2013 and tell us whether you were successful or less than successful. Later on this hour, speaking of resolutions, we're going to be talking about the science and the practicality behind your resolution to get thinner and to lose weight. We're not just going to tell you to do so. We're going to tell you how to do so. That's later this hour.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. Well, this year, they're making resolutions in Washington, of course. And this year, Congress is determined, 2014, they promise, this year they swear it's going to be the year that they're going to find a permanent solution for the dysfunctional system that's called the Medicare Sustainable Growth Rate. That's SGR. What does that mean? SGR is a clunky inside Washington name for the convoluted and politically infected formula that simply pays doctors when they see Medicare patients. And it goes back to 1997, and the point of the SGR, at least to hear the politicians tell it, was to hold down Medicare spending on doctor services. Well, it has never done that. Healthcare costs have continued to rise, and the SGR spending target has never been met. Instead, every year or so for around the last 15 years, the savings baked into this formula, Congress just unbakes it, and it's turned into an unholy process laden with politics and special interest. And it sounds something like this.
We had to take care of seniors and our military personnel by passing the so-called doc fix. We have more than 300,000 people who are on Medicare that need this. They have to have physicians. Physicians can't do it for free. This allows them to get paid. They don't make a lot of money taking care of senior citizens, but it's enough to pay their overhead.
That's Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. That's back in 2010. Now, Harry Reid is far from alone. Republicans and Democrats together constantly say that fixing the SGR, paying the doctors, isn't really about special interest in politics. It's about protecting grandma's access to health care. Is it? Jen Habercorn covers health care for Politico, and she's here to help explain the SGR and whether Congress can actually get it fixed this next year. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm great, and great to have you. Jennifer, the SGR is convoluted, and we don't need to get into the formulas and all the stuff that calculates what doctors get paid. But where does this system come from? How is it that Congress wound up with such a convoluted, complex system that just doesn't work?
Well, the basic idea, like you said, it was to control healthcare costs. So Congress decided in 97 to tie this formula to the nation's GDP. And essentially, in boom times, doctors get paid and they might even get a bonus. But when the economy is down, doctors see decreases. And those decreases started off really small, 1, 2, 4%. But once they started to get bigger, doctors kind of revolted. And Congress said, we don't want doctors angry at us. And most importantly, we don't want the seniors who they treat to be mad at us. So Congress started implementing this doc fix every year, putting a patch on what these cuts were supposed to be. And at this point, those cuts have kind of snowballed to the point where every year this formula calls for 20% cuts in physician payments. No one can really handle a 20% cut in their payment. So Congress just keeps putting a patch on it, keeps having to find more and more money to stop this from going through.
And no one has ever really believed that anyone was going to go up against powerful interests like the AMA or other big doctor groups and actually cut doctors' pay 16 or 20 or 25%. Listen to Senator Tom Coburn right here, Jennifer. He's a Republican from Oklahoma. He's also a physician, and he's one of the loudest critics of this system in Congress.
Are we going to keep playing this cliff game? And we know we're not going to cut physicians significant amount. There's two issues. One is fix the SGR. The other is cut wasteful programs within the federal government to pay for it. If we're going to take money out of Medicare, let's take it to take care of the doctors that are caring for the Medicare patients now. We've not done that. This is the most smoke and mirrors I've ever seen in my entire time in Washington. The game's being played on health care.
Smoke and mirrors, says Tom Coburn, Jennifer Habercorn. One of the criticisms of this whole system was that these 18%, 20% cuts to doctors, they were never going to happen. It was a way for Congress to, 15 years ago, pretend they were going to spend this, they were going to save, rather, this money in the future. They never did it.
Absolutely. I mean, this was supposed to control healthcare costs. It was supposed to drive doctors to order fewer unnecessary tests. But the result has really been that it rewards physicians based on how many tests they order, which, is not the kind of system that is going to save this nation important healthcare money. It really rewards quantity rather than quality.
So what's the promise of fixing it? Instead of paying people for every test and every treatment for grandma and grandpa, what are they going to try to do here?
So the idea is that you want to reward the quality. So you want to reward a doctor. I shouldn't say reward, just pay a doctor for treating perhaps someone's diabetes and their whole kind of spectrum of care that's associated with that instead of each individual test in treating that person's diabetes diagnosis. So lawmakers have come up with a new formula that they want to put into place that would, like I said, treat the diabetes diagnosis rather than the individual tests. That's working its way through Congress right now, and it's unclear when lawmakers return in 2014 whether there's going to be enough momentum to actually get that done.
So they want to say, we're not going to pay you for every test. We'll pay you to get a patient better. We'll pay you more if the patient after your surgery stays out of the hospital, for instance. And that kind of makes sense to a lot of people. How much does all this cost? I heard once it was like $30, $40 billion a year. Where's the money going to come from?
Oh, it's huge amounts of money. Right now, this new form, getting rid of the old formula and putting a new one into place would cost upwards of $150 billion over 10 years. That's a ton of money. In terms of this formula, though, these previous estimates have cost upwards of $300 billion. As healthcare costs have started to decline very, very slightly, it has become cheaper to replace this formula, and that's kind of driven some of this momentum on Capitol Hill to finally get rid of this, finally get rid of the need to do a yearly doc fix, get rid of the system that Senator Coburn was talking about in the clip that just it's really gotten to the point where it's just a gimmick on Capitol Hill now.
It's a shell game, and we're going to spend part of 2014 seeing if this Congress can come up with something like $200 billion to fix the SGR, the doc fix. Jennifer Habercorn of Politico will be watching it along with me. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
As we just heard, one of the items on the political agenda when Congress returns from recess in a few days for 2014 will be to decide whether and how to fix the dysfunctional Medicare Sustainable Growth Rate system known as SGR. This is the system that pays doctors for treating Medicare patients and, according to Tom Coburn, has become smoke and mirrors, a shell game in Washington. Joining us now is Dr. Reid Blackwelder, president of the American Academy of Family Physicians, one of the groups that has the most to gain or lose under the system. Hi, Dr. Blackwelder.
Hello. Thanks for having me here this morning.
And thanks for being here. You know, Coburn is one of the senators who has said that this whole system of the last few 15 years of threatening doctors with a 12% cut, a 15% cut, a 20% cut, really has served to do only one thing, to keep organizations like yours or the AMA, the American Medical Association, coming back to politicians with hat in hand, giving campaign contributions to keep the politicians on their good side so that they don't cut their fees. Do you buy that criticism?
Well, I think the problem with the SGR has been the need for us to go and really talk about the challenges for access to patients with the threatened cut. The reality is we have already paid for the entire SGR repeal with all the patches that have happened over the past 10 years.
Doesn't it, at the same time, though, keep groups like yours and especially the AMA lobbying hard and spending money on campaign contributions? Coburn has said that a lot of people who don't like the SGR say that that's a big problem.
Well, a lot of what happens is the time we spend going to the Hill to advocate for paying for value instead of paying for volume has really centered around the threatened cut every 3, 6, or 12 months. So a lot of the efforts that we've put forth is really more directly in talking with the politicians. You know, the political game does involve contributions and PACs, but most of it is truly sitting down with people trying to talk about changing the way we provide for and pay for, especially primary care in this country.
And so the idea of stopping, no longer paying for every little test, every little screening, every little treatment, and instead paying holistically for the diabetes care or paying holistically for somebody with congestive heart failure, for instance. Doctors, you know, have had a hard time accepting that, saying that, well, people who treat sicker people will be singled out and it'll look like they don't have quality. And doctors haven't exactly made these moves easy over the last few years.
Well, the challenge is switching the way we provide care from the individual systems in which you're paid for fee-for-service, as you say, paying for each test, to team-based care in which we're making sure patients get the right care in the right place at the right time from the right person. And it's a very transformative way of taking care of patients. But we're seeing movements. Our own members have been transforming to use more of team-based care. And we're really trying to find more and more ways to advocate for paying for value. And there are aspects of the bicameral and bipartisan suggestion that really feed into this new process.
You are a primary care physician, and you're the head of a big organization of family physicians, primary care doctors. One of the main criticisms of this whole system, as Obamacare gets up and running and people are trying to save money, that there's really no way to really save on health costs in the long run unless guys like you get paid more and guys like the orthopedic surgeons and the heart surgeons just get paid less. It's really as simple as that in the end.
Well, what's really important is that we pay for outcomes instead of procedures, and that we've shown in their pilot program showing that we can improve patient outcomes at better satisfaction for patients and physicians at lower cost to the system as a whole, and everybody will win in this new process.
When Congress comes back in just a few days, they will resume the debate on a $200 to $300 billion problem It's called the SGR, and it's the way doctors get paid under Medicare. Dr. Reid Blackwelder is one of the most important people on the doctor side of that debate, president of the American Academy of Family Physicians. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Heightened security measures are in place in the Russian city of Volgograd after two twin bombings killed at least 34 people and injured dozens more earlier this week. More than 5,000 security forces are on duty in that city of 1 million. But Russian security services and the U.S. Olympic Committee have said that in the wake of these bombings, they will not be taking any extra measures to shore up security or increase the screening of attendees at the Sochi Games themselves. And as these bombings reveal, managing the security concerns at events like the Olympics is difficult and thankless, even under the most ideal conditions. And there are questions about the larger security issues in the Caucasus region of Russia and whether the Olympics will distract from potential dangers there. Kimberly Martin is political science professor at Barnard College and a Russia expert and joins me now. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Tan.
No new security people in Sochi say after these bombings. Is that just rhetoric of confidence coming from the government and Olympic organizers? Do you buy it, or are they just trying to seem confident?
I don't think that the terrorist attacks were a surprise to anybody, because back in July, the figurehead of the Caucasus terrorist movement in Russia, Doku Umarov, called on his supporters to disrupt the Olympics, to disrupt what was happening in Sochi. And so I think the reason that they're not calling for stronger measures is that the strongest measures that they can possibly have are already in place. It's really important to Putin to have a success at Sochi, and he's been expecting this all along.
So it's fair then to interpret the Volgograd bombings as a message from the separatists: we can hit you.
No question. And what's really interesting is that the head of the Southern Federal District, where Volgograd is one of the major cities and also where Sochi is located, the head of that district, Vladimir Ustinov, is a close member of Putin's personal network. And we've talked before on this show about how Putin stays in power because of these network connections, and he's really good at balancing off people. And this particular individual is from the security sector. He's the former justice minister. He's the former chief prosecutor of Russia. He's written a book on terrorism. And now the terrorists are saying to him, we can hit you in your own backyard, in this important city in your region, and you can't do anything about it.
What does it mean to Putin and these networks to have a terror-free Games? And is that a realistic expectation?
You never know for sure what's going to happen at the Games. Obviously, we already had the terrible experience in 1972 at Munich about having a terrible security problem at the Games. But I think that these are likely to be as successful as they can possibly be. And what I'm most concerned about is not the Games themselves, but what comes afterwards. Because we're already seeing signs of a Russian nationalist response to these to the terrorist attacks that follows on a very pitched conflict that happened this past October in Moscow between people from the Caucasus and Central Asia and ethnic Russians. I'm afraid that that could spiral out of control.
Now, there have been some indications over the last year that at least Chechnya, the part of the conflict that we in America are most familiar with, has at least quieted down some. But as I understand it, the conflict has really spread to Dagestan and other Caucasus republics or other Caucasus parts of Russia. What is this pretend for, you know, the next year after the Games have been performed and are gone?
Well, the reason that Chechnya has been so successful is that the head of Chechnya, Ramzan Kadyrov, who is by all measures a warlord, he's somebody who cooperates very closely with Putin, but he's a brutal, violent man. And the reason that terrorism has disappeared in Chechnya is that he has just absolutely stamped it out by killing people, by imprisoning families if their family members have been accused of terrorist attacks. And what has happened is that it's no longer happening in Chechnya, but it's just been spread across the borders elsewhere in the North Caucasus. And you're right, Dagestan's the major part right now. So I think that the fear would be that the Russian state would now say, after Sochi, so after the attention of the international community is no longer on them, that they're going to do the same kind of similar brutal crackdown in Dagestan that they've done in Chechnya. And the sad thing is that it's not likely to be effective in the long run, because every place that you push, the people who are so angry and so filled with despair, the politics are just going to come out somewhere else, and it's not going to lead to a resolution of the real problems that these people face.
The two bombings this week in Volgograd have pointed up security concerns around the Sochi Winter Games. Kimberly Martin is here to say that the problems are much, much more broadly than that, and perhaps the biggest problem arises after the Games, after the medals have been awarded and everyone has gone home. Kimberly Martin, political science professor at Barnard College. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd. Great to be back.
Well, as we just heard, Russian security services have announced that they do not plan to take extra measures to shore up security in the wake of the two bombings in the Russian city of Volgograd. But clearly, an event like the Volgograd terrorist attacks have raised new concerns over safety at the upcoming Winter Games in Sochi. Let's think about the situation for a second. Two successful terrorist attacks just hit 400 miles outside the city where the Olympic Games will begin in just 5 weeks. The coastal town of Sochi is preparing to host nearly 7,000 athletes, 120,000 visitors, and thousands more volunteers and press for Russia's first Olympic Winter Games. What are you thinking if you're in charge of security? Well, we have two people joining us now who are probably the best people to answer that question. Mark Camillo was the Secret Service Security Coordinator for the 2002 Salt Lake City Winter Olympics, and Bill Rathburn coordinated security for the 1996 Atlanta Summer Games, an event, of course, marred by the Centennial Olympic Park bombing. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you, gentlemen. Mark, let me start with you, because an event like Volgograd happens just weeks before a major Olympic event. What goes through your mind or through the mind of somebody like you when a massive terrorist event in another city takes place in such close proximity to the Games?
Well, the security planners already have initiated their operation. What they are likely doing is going back, reviewing their existing plan, and looking for ways to enhance it based on what they know to be the immediate threat. And at this particular juncture, they're focusing on weapons of mass destruction.
Now, Mark, you planned security in 2002, which, of course, was not long after 9/11. We get reports this morning that security planners in Sochi say no new security measures because of this bombing. Is that just rhetoric? Do you buy it that there are no new security measures after those bombings?
Well, if their plan was solid with a substantial platform and a layered security system, I can understand their comment.
I sort of interpreted that statement as just maybe a statement of public confidence and not much more.
Well, I think it is important to bolster the public confidence, because the venues likely are in a super safe mode right now. It's in between the venues and those areas, perhaps transportation and accommodations, is where they have to push out to enhance the security in those areas.
So that's interesting. The games themselves are probably super secure, but all of the infrastructure and places in public where people go might be the soft points. Bill Rathburn, let me turn to you, because you were in charge in 1996 in Atlanta, and of course there was a security failure. Now, it was small compared to Volgograd, and almost in a way seems quaint in retrospect, but what lessons learned came from 1996, do you think?
Well, a number of lessons came from 1996. Certainly, we realized that before the Olympics that the park was vulnerable. We could not close off all of Atlanta. So we decided that the park was a public gathering place. And for a whole variety of reasons, we decided not to screen people into the park. Now, had we done that, we might have created a more significant incident if a bomb had gone off on Peachtree Street or something, or been placed on Peachtree Street. The area might not have been as cleared as it was when the bomb detonated. That is one thing that's important to Sochi. The bomb on Sunday at the train station was outside of a metal detector. You can have any number of security layers or perimeters, but at some point you have to screen people through those layers or those perimeters. And so I believe that bombing on Sunday, as well as one on Monday, are viewed as successes by the terrorists. To the extent that they were successes, then that same kind of thing is a great concern during the Olympics.
And so as planners think about the Olympics, they really inevitably have to know that the softer targets remain soft. You can't lock down an entire city. And it makes me want to ask you, Bill Rathburn, when an event like this happens, you had an event in 96. Do people like you, security-minded and the planners, then face pressure from politicians or PR people who demand that the games look good, remain open, appear to be, you know, democratic and happy and fun, when it's your responsibility to try to make sure something terrible doesn't happen?
Yes, it's a matter of trying to balance all of those objectives. And I really think that's one of the problems that Russia is going to have in Sochi. The games are an opportunity for Russia to showcase itself to the world. Vladimir Putin has taken a very personal interest and a personal involvement in the preparations for the games. And I think that makes the games an even more attractive target for terrorist groups like the ones that conducted these two recent bombings. It's to embarrass the country and to embarrass Putin himself as a face of Russia. So I think that increases the threat significantly. To my knowledge, this is the first time there's ever been a direct, credible threat to the Olympic Games, the threat from the Chechen group that was issued back in July.
And Mark Camilla, before we let you go, does it make it more difficult for somebody like you and Bill when a leader like Vladimir Putin or any leader really has a lot at stake in putting on a games that looks good and maybe they put pressure on security people to back off?
Every head of state does provide a letter of guarantee, if you will, that says that they will use all resources and capabilities available to ensure the safety and security of all those competing and in attendance. So they're not taking this lightly. They unfortunately have to deal with events that are occurring in proximity. They know that as safe as their venues are going to be, and the fact that they've eliminated vehicles and other conveyances of explosive devices, they still have to deal with things that are happening out in the periphery, if you will.
We're happy to have two of the people who stay up at night trying to keep games safe. Mark Camilla was the Secret Service Security Coordinator for the 2002 Salt Lake City Winter Olympics, and Bill Rathburn coordinated security in 1996 at the Atlanta Summer Games. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today, filling in for John Hockenberry. All this hour, we're hearing about the New Year's resolutions that you made 1 year ago.
Bruce from Tallahassee, Florida. Last year, I made the same resolution I make every year, to lose weight. This year, I actually did it. I just cut down on carbs and actually lost about 20, 25 pounds this year, the last part of the year. So that's pretty cool.
Yes, Bruce, that is definitely pretty cool. This listener writes that their New Year's resolution was, quote, to lose weight and get fit for my daughter's wedding. I lost 25 pounds, worked out several times a week for many months, and still looked fat and flabby. I've gained at least 10 pounds and stopped exercising since the day of the wedding. Well, dieting and exercise and losing weight, eating better. Every year, Americans make resolutions to be healthier. It's one of the most common resolutions we make and then break. And so we wanted to spend a little bit of time exploring some practical ways that we can think about getting healthier and reexamine what we're putting into our bodies. And that's why we have Barry Popkin. He is Distinguished Professor of Public Health at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And when it comes to the three most common New Year's resolutions about our health, Barry is here to help us understand in a scientific way how to realize some of these goals. Resolution number one, he says, of course, exercise.
Obviously, we have not increased our exercise. We decreased it as a population, and that is critical that we walk or run or just move.
Resolution number two, you say stop drinking beverages with calories, including juice.
Yes, absolutely. It is the one thing that we know for sure increases weight and the risk of diabetes and many cancers and heart disease.
And resolution three, no more snacking.
Cut down your snacking. We aren't going to cut it out, but people are snacking 2 to 4 to 6, 8 times a day. Cut it down.
Okay, now I'm going to suggest that nobody was surprised by any of those resolutions. I've made several of them myself, and probably a lot of people listening to us say, yeah, I know I'm not supposed to snack. So let's get into the data-driven world of making it happen a little bit. What do we know about the habits of people who manage to stay in shape versus the habits of people who just have trouble?
First, we know that thin people do not eat very much extra on weekends, and that means Friday, Saturday, and Sunday versus the rest of the week, whereas most Americans consume 120 to 200 more calories per day on the weekend, those 3 days, and it comes from alcohol and fat. So they're consuming a lot of salty snacks, a lot of junk food, a lot of pizzas and other kinds of things that are really high fat, and more alcohol. So that's the first big thing when you think of holidays and weekends as a big cause that people aren't conscious about.
So let's say on practicality there, people, a lot of people probably want to be more conscious during Saturday college football and Sunday pro football. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, then they should have fruit and have grapes and apples and other kinds of things like that, more of that. Try to have more water around and diet beverages as well as all the beer and other stuff. And probably if I went down to Super Bowl weekend and New Year's weekend and Christmas weekend and Thanksgiving, those together probably account for a third or fourth of weight gain that we see.
Yeah, they add up is the bottom line there. Now, your resolution number two, stop drinking beverages with calories. That's a lot of juice. Americans' consumption of sugary beverages has just skyrocketed in the last 20 years.
That's right. First, you've got to realize that 75% of every food that we consume and beverage has added sugar in it. That includes fruit juice concentrate, which is used for a lot of your audience. It's kind of the natural sugar, even found in a quarter of infant formula. Ridiculously so. Huh. So we're getting sugar everywhere. But in beverages, it's particularly critical because we think we're going to cut our food intake and we feel full when we have a smoothie or a fruit juice or milk or soft drinks and other things. But we aren't. And we don't change our total food intake. So beverages is the top target. That's why Mayor Bloomberg went after it. That's why Mexico put a big tax on the sugar-sweetened beverages. And that's why we say cut your sports drinks, cut your energy drinks, cut your juice, cut your soft drinks with calories. Go to water, diet beverages, coffee and tea with little bits of sugar, and you'll be a lot healthier.
Resolution three, stop snacking. What do we know about our snacking habits that we can really make a dent in if we want to be serious about a resolution?
We shifted from consuming a half a snack a day in the 70s to consuming three snacks on the average now. And we actually have about 25% of Americans that eat constantly. They report 8 to 10 snacks a day, which means they're always eating. And you have no appetite control. It's all based on impulse and everything else. And secondly, the snacks have gotten really large, and they become composed more and more of soft drinks and junk food. So what we need to do is, if we're going to snack on healthier foods half the time, so celery, grapes, apples, many, many kinds of healthy items, put them into part of your snacks. Cut down the size of your snacks. Americans consume several hundred calories from snack. They used to consume 50 to 100.
Barry Popkin, who's responsible for this? I don't think that Americans have sat around collectively and said, you know what, I used to have a half a snack. I think I'm going to turn the dial up to three. Who's responsible for this change in behavior?
I'll give you the clear answer. It's a marketing issue. It's the marketing sector, and it's the big food and beverage companies that have sold us on this. And the best example is let's shift over to a billion people over in China. They essentially, before they started getting modern marketing and modern food, never snacked. No one snacked. We spend 70 hours in 25,000 to 30,000 people's homes watching everything they eat over 3 days, and essentially they never snacked in the 80s. Then we come back in the last decade, in the 90s, and now really in the last 8 or 10 years, and snacking has gone up and up and up from nothing to doubling each every 2 years. So essentially, marketing has gone in and said, snacking's the new unsold food. We can sell food and drink by advertising and convincing them this is the way modern people live and eat and drink. You can think of all the ads. Be active and hold a Coke or a Pepsi in your hand. Be active and eat these Dorito chips and so forth. All these ads on sports drinks and energy drinks and everywhere you move. There's a juice bar or a soft drink vending machine or a juice vending machine. It's there everywhere to sell you. You go to a gym and they have tons of energy drinks that are giving you the same calories.
Maybe it's time for people to start to think about who has something to gain when you're gaining all those calories.
That's absolutely correct. And who is paying the billions of dollars to try to stop anybody from cutting some of this out?
Dr. Barry Popkin is Distinguished Professor of Public Health at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. He says exercise, stop drinking beverages with calories, and stop snacking. And also keep in mind who has something to gain when you gain. Dr. Barry Popkin, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
There's Jimmy playing it left-handed. You know, we've spent some time today looking back on 2013 and looking forward to 2014. And as we're looking back, I wanted to take a second and let you know who some of the people are who make this show sound so very good every single day. I think John Hockenberry would agree with me that he and I really have the easy jobs on this show. There are a lot of people behind the scenes and through the glass who make this show sound the way it does. People like Ellen Frankman, Mythili Rao, Jillian Weinberger, Jolenta Greenberg, Liz Ross. TJ Raphael does all of our web stuff in the control room. Kristen Meinzer, Jake Howard, our director, Vince Fairchild on the board. Irva Gunja is our senior producer, right along with Jen Poyant. And Rupert Allman is our boss, the dear leader. Thanks to all of them for making this show sound so very good every single day. And thanks to you for listening in 2013. We'll see you tomorrow in 2014. John Hockenberry will be back. I'm Todd Zwillick. Happy New Year.